All right, here we are once again. Welcome back to Film Buffs. Today, Jono, Alex, and I are going to be talking about the 1954 classic, On the Waterfront. So, how are we feeling about this film? Alex, let's start with you.
I feel like I disappointed all the film students in the world because I did not enjoy it this time.
Okay. Care to elaborate?
Yeah. I think that it's the kind of movie that you watch when you're going to film school. And you enjoy it because, like, whoa, it's Marlon Brando. Well, it's so cool to see him when he was young and you know, seeing like, oh, this is new acting technique that was coming and all that. Mm-hmm. But when you watch it, when you already went through that years ago, it's not as great. Mm. Like, I couldn't follow the story. I think it's a memorable part of cinema, but it did not connect with me.
Right.
Anymore. Yeah.
All right. Jono?
Yeah. So I tried to watch this movie 3 times. And I feel really bad too. I feel like I'm hurting. I felt more concerned that I was hurting you guys by not successfully watching this film. But I mean, I did. It played through, but I lost my attention. Just kept waning on it each time. So I watched it the second time, and I was like, okay, pay attention this time. And then I didn't at certain parts. And then I tried the third time, and I just turned it off and went to bed because I was like, you know what? If I didn't get it the second time, I don't deserve it the third time. So it for me was, I'd call it an epic fail. But surprisingly, though, rewatching it, I was like, oh, like I was surprised how much I did absorb based on that first viewing experience.
So what was it about the film that didn't connect with you guys?
Everything?
Well, everything's too general. We need to be a little more specific. No.
I feel like it was, for me, I don't know. It is hard to kind of pinpoint why it is. It's not because it's a... I guess it is kind of... how do you explain this? It's like it's been done before so many times, and it's not, and but this was more of a seminal film, I guess, right? Like it was original, but that kind of story's been done so much, you're just like, yeah, I get it. But it's almost unfortunate because that would be a classic film. Other films have taken that story structure or that kind of theme and done something with it. And it's just been, it feels like it's been done to death, but then to watch it, it's like, yeah, you get it. You know, it's the classic, but you feel bad like it's been done to death, but it wasn't done to death when this film first came out.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, I agree.
Does that make
sense?
Yeah,
like it reminded me of, I don't know if you guys saw Rumblefish.
I know it, but I haven't seen it, no.
Well, they don't have a lot to do with each other, but they do in a way. It's like a similar character and all. So, yeah, I agree with Jono. Like, I couldn't follow it that much because I've seen it before. Recently, in other movies.
So, when you say you couldn't follow it, like, what do you mean you couldn't follow it? Like, you couldn't follow the story? You couldn't pick out the themes, or what?
No, I picked up the themes, but I couldn't follow. Like I meant more that I couldn't connect with the film.
Okay, you couldn't.
I think that's more what I try to say.
Right.
Yeah,
you didn't engage with
it. Exactly. Like it reminded me of The Irishman that I saw a few months ago. Mm-hmm. Like all the union things and all this stuff, and I was like, man, I'm so tired of this subject. Mm. Like I've heard about it so many times, and I know it was relevant back then, and I know the importance of the film, but it just, I mean, I don't care anymore, you know?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate, okay. Well, like I said, because it's a classic, and you know that it's a classic, but it is true. Like, this story has It's in so many. It's something similar to it. You know, that little guy overcoming the big bully kind of illegal organization.
Are you trying to say David and Goliath?
Yeah. Yes, I am. But even just the union thing is like, that's always a Goliath, you know, like that's also this guy who's kind of just got caught up in that same, like a lot of these things have been done so many other times in film where it's this, you know, someone just trying to get by, you know, doing their thing. This is the way things are now. And then finally having their conscience gripped, and usually by a more kind of pure angelic female influence that comes along, right? Like the ragged, you know, guy that got pushed around by the bully, who's not really actually, doesn't even seem like he's been pushed around. He's just kind of a cool guy who is useful to them, and he kind of feels indifferent. Kind of like, you know, there's a certain element to the Casablanca, what's his name? Rick.
Rick.
Yeah, just like indifferent, doesn't care so much. But then some conscience comes into it, right? You know, in this one. And then he decides, like, you know what? Maybe this is all wrong. And then he fights back. But, I mean, there's lots of really good stuff in there, like the boxing thing kind of theme, like that being knocked down, being a sellout, actually could have been something. You know, that theme throughout. I rewatched the ending just before this, so I picked up on a few things.
Well, that's good.
I actually watched it like 2 hours before our
Oh, perfect. Because I was like, before I watched the ending, I'm like, I think I just need a little refresher kicker here. Just to, like, get that.
The same thing that happened to you happened to me. Like, I started watching it 3 weeks ago. I'm like, man, I can do this. I can do this. It's like 25
minutes. 3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, same thing.
Every week was like, I'm going to do it this time. I need to do it this time. It was tough.
Yeah, no, it's the exact same thing happened to me. I'm like, why can't I watch this thing properly? I was so frustrated with myself. Also, not. I was enjoying my time being distracted. I was probably eating something or.
Yeah. What were you eating, Jono? This sounds like a Homer Simpson moment.
Oh, no. Homer wouldn't eat what I was eating. I was probably.
No, but you remember the food more than what you were doing.
It's true, yes. Homer does have memories mostly around food.
Okay, so
what about you, Dan?
I found approaching this film, like, I had seen it years ago and I'd forgotten a fair amount of it, especially the end. And it took me about a week to really get any sort of real thought about this film, because I approached it, you know, watching it today and the union thing, and obviously I agree with you guys on that. Like, we are so far removed from that time that it was harder to connect with that situation. But then the more I thought about it, the more I actually really like what the film is about. So, and, like, you know, obviously you guys have said it's been repackaged in several ways since then, but to me, I started looking at some of the things, like, what's the real issue of the film. And what do they keep coming back to? And there's this constant, like, suppression of the truth that's underlying the whole film. So you have the corrupt union leaders who are essentially the king, and everyone is there at the beginning in the pool room, and they're paying tribute to him. And he discards people who speak out against him, right? That's why Joey dies at the beginning. But then Brando is the character who knows the truth, but doesn't know how to go about presenting it, right? Like, he knows what will change, but he's afraid of that change. And so what I like is that once he does finally speak the truth, you know, people say all the time today, speak truth to power, right? Which is a silly cultural thing today, but he finally speaks the truth, and it's the idea that speaking the truth will shape the world accordingly and properly. So once he finally does that, then the world changes for the better, which I like that theme.
Yeah, it's nice, but, you know, I still feel the same way. It's a good movie.
Which is why I feel, the reason why I regret not properly investing and not, I guess the story, like not feeling like as gripped as I could have, I guess I should have sat down and I know it's a classic for a reason, obviously. And you do, like Dan, you saying that immediately, like it clicks with me again. Like you're like, yes, there are themes here. They are recurring. There's also the theme of him, like the regrets he has of essentially his career being a lie. A suppression of the truth that he's a good boxer. He's a contender, if you will.
That's right.
I could have been somebody.
There's so many Marlon Brando moments. Which is why I just like, I do love Marlon Brando. Like there's the Godfather Marlon Brando that's very impersonable. But like this one too has like, there's, you can see where that voice also comes from. It's those things.
Yeah, he was a famous mumbler.
So mumbling. Yeah. But like,
yeah, sometimes I can't understand him.
Well, that was another thing. Yeah. That was a real, okay, but I want to hear. So you're like, these themes, like they're there and you're like, this is cool. You know, this is good storytelling. You know, it works. But at the same time, there's like this lack of, for me, it was just, they didn't like, I was like, I wish I was just a little bit more stoked and like gripped by this film. Casablanca gripped me, which was surprising. This kind of had the effect that I thought Casablanca was going to have on me, which was, it feels a bit dated. The pacing is slow at points. I know that the actress in it's kind of a new, it was her like premier role.
Her first film.
Because they did that too, because they said that, I was like, I kind of watched her performance more closely and kind of, it didn't feel as good as other classics I've seen. I mean, it was fine, but like, I don't know. It all felt quite theatrical from her end, which was old school too, right? Like, I'm not saying that it was a bad acting job. It felt like I was watching an older film, whereas Casablanca, I felt like, man, this, I'm really enjoying this, and it's the complete opposite happened to me. But then again, like I've seen On the Waterfront before too, many years ago, and I did enjoy it when I first watched it. It might have been because it was a rewatch for me years later, but I respected a lot of the themes, and I know that they're there, and I know it's a good movie for a reason, and I didn't miss everything, obviously. But yeah.
So let's try and crack that open a bit. So what is it about the difference? Because, I mean, this is a newer film than Casablanca, right? Casablanca was released in 42, I believe, and this is 54. Yeah, so what's the difference?
I think that above all is the theme, like love and a hero like Rick is more timeless than this particular movie that is set in a moment in time that it's not like, I think it doesn't transcend as much as Casablanca did.
I know that does, because that's an interesting point. I was just thinking that, is that the reason why it feels like it doesn't date as well is because Casablanca was the time it was set in, kind of the environment that created the situation that they were all in, it had this scale to it, even though the setting was quite small, and everyone knows about that environment, like the weight of that time. You feel that weight. With this one, it's like union issues, work hour issues, like stuff that just, it actually felt older than Casablanca in the sense that it just was like, these issues feel so distant, you know, like standing out just with hoping for work that involves moving crates and boxes with a hook, you know?
Right.
Like, I don't know. It's interesting that you bring up the difference in time between the two, because the gravity of the situation in Casablanca felt more tangible and real and relatable, I guess, because of our familiarity with that history so much, because we learned so much more about that in school, I guess. I don't know. That for me felt more weighted than this, and this felt like a time far gone, even more so than Casablanca.
Mm. Yeah.
But maybe not. Totally. That might be ignorant
to
say. I mean,
no, I think... look, I mean, I don't think that anyone listening is going to be offended by comments like that, so I think it's okay to explore them. But that is an interesting point, that maybe the size and the gravity of the situation is that much higher. The stakes are that much higher for way more people. So maybe that's why Casablanca... And, I mean, the pacing of Casablanca is pretty timeless. Like, it doesn't lag at all.
Mm-hmm.
And
no, it always...
I think you're right. Like, there were a few technical things about this film that, to me, they stood out. There was one cut, I don't know if you guys remember it or not, where it's at the beginning when they first show the union guys on the docks and they're all waiting for work. And then there's the big guy who's the doorkeeper with the flat-brimmed cap that's flipped up.
Yeah.
Remember him?
Yeah.
He hands out the chits.
He's at the end as well.
They cut to him. And he's standing in front of what looks like a black screen, but I guess it's the door to the docks, but it's such an odd cut that you can, it's obviously a pickup, and it felt so out of place to me. Do you guys remember that shot?
I don't.
All right. Well,
say
to me, that was one of the technical things that stood out is kind of dating it a bit. But one of the things I really liked is that the blocking of the camera and the actors in this film I thought was really, really good.
Mm.
I liked watching it. There was something, there's not a lot of cutting to show action. There's a lot of the actors moving through the frames.
Yeah, long shots.
One of the ones I really liked was, again, at the beginning of the film after Brando gets Joey thrown off the roof. He goes and he stands with the union guys, the mob guys, and there's his brother, and he stands in a line, and the camera looks down the line as they stand against the wall, and you have the top union guy, his brother, and then what's his name in the film? Brando's name?
Jerry?
Terry.
Terry, yeah.
Terry.
So then Terry stands at the end. And you look down the line, and Terry's the last in the line. And then as he's talking, he addresses one person, then he moves up closer to his brother, and then he moves up, and he walks into a close-up.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought the blocking of that stuff was really, really nicely done. You don't see much of that anymore.
Dude, I feel bad. Like, I don't remember
almost
any of the shots.
There's some really nice stuff happening in there.
As the guy, as the murder takes place at the beginning, he's standing in the club lineup, and then they're like, someone fell off the roof. And then Terry starts kind of coming to realizations about it. He's like, I thought they were just maybe going to rough him up, like that whole thing. And then he's just kind of like reasoning through it, and everyone denies.
But what's interesting though is like as he's reasoning through it,
he's moving closer to the camera.
He's moving closer to the camera, right? But he's also moving closer to the characters who are the cause of that,
right?
Right. So he's getting closer to the truth in his mind and through the dialogue, and then closer to the actual characters, which I thought was brilliant blocking.
Yeah, that's true. There is some really interesting blocking that happened in this.
Yeah. So this was directed by Elia Kazan. I think it's Elia Kazan. And he was a very famous director. He worked with Brando in his film adaptation of Streetcar, same director, and several other pieces with Brando. And Brando and him got along really well, and they really liked each other. But then Kazan got blacklisted by the Hollywood community because he would had communist sympathies. And then he never really worked again, unfortunately.
He was from Turkey, right?
I'm not sure.
Well, and
I think he was.
Can't blame him for being a little. Just kidding.
Yeah, like.
Please don't take that's a joke, everybody.
That's staying in.
anyways, yeah, no,
but Kazan was widely known as is one of the best directors for a while.
Really?
Yeah.
If you,
yeah, he also did. I think he did East of Eden with James.
And he
Dean.
Got cut. Hollywood locked him out. Man.
Yeah.
Oh well. Well, he did. He had a good portfolio of work. He should be proud.
Yeah.
He should be very
proud.
What
did you guys think of? I don't know if it was just my entertainment system. Well, two things, audio-wise. Did you find that the mix was, it was very hard to, like, hear dialogue at points? Was that just me? Because I was, like, playing around with like audio settings, and I was like the way stuff was said. I don't know if it was even Marlon Brando being a mumbler, but there were just points where I was like, I don't know what anybody just said in that scene. I don't know what it was, but also like another thing that kind of I don't know if how you guys felt about the soundtrack, but it feels very campy almost. In the sense that
it's very dramatic.
It's incredibly dramatic, which is why I also kind of had that perspective on it. Like the soundtrack was just like very like this music here is to elevate the drama of the situation noticeably.
Right. Yeah.
Which I thought was interesting. And I wonder if at the time, like that kind of stuff really did elevate the film, but that almost feels like something that dates it as well, is that the soundtrack was such a classic. Like if you were to spoof a film of that era, you would have a soundtrack like that. And we're just like, Beanie!
Right.
You know, like those really like,
yeah. Yeah.
<It's> like, I could have been a contender. Beanie! Like, it's like this, these huge swells and like, I don't know. Like for me, it was, I mean, it's nice. I get it. But I did think that it was an interesting like musical choice as well. In some instances. So
it is interesting. The one part that I really remember was when he tells Edie, that he was the one who had Joey killed or set up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they walk down by the train tracks, I think it is, right? And the train goes by.
Oh, yeah, and she can't hear him, yeah.
Well, she can hear him, but the audience can't. And then
yeah.
I think she even screams in silence or in it's drowned out and then runs away.
Right.
That one was very dramatic for me.
Like over-the-top dramatic or moments. Stylistically well-done dramatic?
I would... I remember it feeling a little over the top.
Mm. Still, it's an interesting...
But at the same time, it is an interesting choice, though.
Yeah. I feel like that, right, 'cause that's like that would have been unique for the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think maybe looking at this film now, it's obviously 60 years on?
No, like 60-something,
like
yeah.
Yeah, 60-something.
Yeah, like 64 years old, yeah.
Wow.
You maybe take these decisions for granted that have become refined over time, perhaps. But, you know, you could say that in that scene in particular, with Edie at the trains, like, she's an innocent, right? Like, she's been sent away to boarding school her whole life, and she's been raised by nuns, essentially. And so now she's learning that the person she's fallen in love with was responsible for having her brother killed. So maybe you could say that it reflects the mental state of the character in hearing that news.
Yeah. As in,
That's it? Just yes?
As in, like she feels overwhelmed by confusion?
Yeah. Yeah. So...
Yeah.
I mean, how would one person feel in that moment, right? So the choice, I'm saying, while might seem heavy-handed today, it was probably working on a level that we're used to it being a little softer today. But I think that the choice is interesting in that sense.
I actually think that was a good choice. I don't have a problem with that. I like that kind of stuff. I don't think that's taking it too far. I think that to me does show thought. It does show it is layered. Mm-hmm. So that to me isn't over dramatic. I feel like that actually makes sense from a storytelling standpoint as a tool for that. Like just what you said, the confusion, you don't need to hear what's said. You just know that it's chaotic.
You know what's
And that
mm-hmm. and as an audience you already know it.
Yeah, and it's like it's frustrating, it's confusing, it's disorienting, it's almost you don't remember what you say in those moments.
Yeah.
Which is perfectly fine to me. Like that's actually cool. Again, the soundtrack for me was just like audio wise. I thought that was I did feel like again, these things have been become cliches, and it's almost unfortunate that but then I guess you have to just stop for a second and think it's cliche because a film like this did such a good job of it, I guess, that most others copied it.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, Brando won the Oscar for this one.
Yeah.
He did a great job.
So, maybe we should just continue this in all Brando voices.
The whole podcast.
Yeah. I really thought this was a pretty small film.
What's the Simpsons quote? Marlon Brando, world's greatest living actor. Yes. Isn't that it?
Yeah, something like that, yeah. I just like my favorite Marlon Brando impersonation to this date is the Robin Hood Men in Tights Godfather scene.
Oh, God, that is so good.
And the sheriff.
You never once invited me to your house for a pastry or a canoe. A go what? A canoe, you know, it's a pastry. It's got sprinkles on it.
Sprinkles on it.
Yeah, such a good. That's my favorite. That's like the exact moment that I'm talking about. But also, he's like, how are you gonna get him to do this? And then he gets cut off by his assistant. We'll make him an offer he can't refuse. I was gonna say that. Just like throws a bunch of nuts at him.
I was gonna say that.
Hey, I was gonna say that. I will take these cotton balls from you with my hand and put them in my pocket.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm sorry. Okay. I went to
the dentist. I got these cotton balls.
It's just this like most like ridiculous Marlon Brando scene, like for no reason in the film.
But it's so good.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Brando.
Okay, so this film won 8 Oscars. Got Best Picture, Best Actor, Best Actress, Best Director, Best Writing, Story, and Screenplay, Best Cinematography, Best Art Direction, and Best Film Editing.
Yeah.
Plus 4 other nominations.
But it's no Titanic still.
Yeah, it's no Return of the King.
Well. That's right. Are those really fair comparisons?
Yeah, especially the Titanic. I think that one got 12 Oscars, didn't it?
No,
that's right. It couldn't get the 12.
Yeah. It didn't win any of the acting
Titanic
categories.
And the King Good.
I don't think a film has gotten more than 11.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It hasn't.
Because they seem to. If they get all the technical awards, they don't ever really seem to get the acting awards.
That's true. Yeah. It's very true. Like Star Wars, A New Hope.
Like Star Wars New Hope.
I just watched the behind the scenes on that. I love that one, actually. It's a great the making of Star Wars documentary, George Lucas's kind of story on Disney Plus.
Yeah.
Get Disney Plus just to watch it. It's really good. Anyway, sorry, on the waterfront.
Yeah, that's fine. We're already talked on.
Is there no more you guys want to talk about?
Can we just talk about the Star Wars documentary? We're not film buffs. We're losers.
I haven't seen the Star Wars documentary.
You probably have. You probably stumbled across it on YouTube. It's really good. It's like all about how Star Wars was a disaster on the onset and then it was saved in the edit. Like all of those things, it just like it gets all brought into one. But it's beautiful because it's like it's such an amazing success story. It was going to be such a mess. It seemed everybody hated it, and then it became this like worldwide phenomenon. Could you imagine if you created something like that? Oh man, that like it like all that stress, all that stress just becomes wow, I actually did it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, on the waterfront.
Yeah, he was physically sick.
Yeah,
I think he's recovered.
How do we feel about Carl Malden, who played Father Barry?
Oh man, like I feel bad that
the priest.
Yeah, I remember him.
He'll be in the church if you need him.
You guys are terrible. Can't remember the film.
I remember Father Barry.
I remember him. I remember him when they're in the bar fighting. I remember that. I think that I just don't care.
No, I remember Father Barry. I do. I enjoyed, wait a minute here. Did I enjoy Father Barry? I did. I thought he was, an interesting character. I mean, he kind of carries a lot. He's coaching. He also has these kind of like realizations about himself. Like there's a lot of great turns in characters in this film. Marlon Brando obviously is a major, has major turns. Or character shifts, you know, like scenes have the great structure. It's an analyzable film, in many ways. And Father Barry is obvious. Like he, even on the outside of the film, like I just said this to Alex, but I'll be in the church if you need me. He says that to what's her nose, and she gets real
Edie.
Yeah, she gets really mad at him and freaks out, and he kind of all of a sudden realizes like. Me just being saying I'm there means nothing. Like he has this big shift of responsibility where he's like the difference between what right and wrong is as long as if a good man does nothing, then he's not really he's not a good man. Like he realizes that, right? Like he's just, if he's just speaking into these scenes and not actively doing anything about the problem. So he's kind of this, I think they do a good job of kind of using him as this beacon of morality and truth. And he's constantly encouraging people to speak out and tell the truth after that moment, right? He has a pretty quick shift in character.
Yeah. Yeah. I like him. I like him as an actor too. He's in, not on the waterfront. He plays, what's that other movie, Brando? I was just talking about it. Damn it. Come on. The one I just mentioned that Kazan directed. Streetcar. He was in Streetcar as well.
Yeah. Oh, is he? Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. He plays the guy who he falls in love with Blanche.
Oh.
One of Brando's best friends.
I need to watch that again.
So, yeah.
Another interesting thing is he's kind of used as kind of a... Like the boxing analogy, obviously, that used as a form of regret in like career choices for Marlon Brando, Terry. But he kind of like plays this kind of like boxing coach kind of role of like, this is what you need to do. Like even at the end, he's kind of like fixing up Terry's vest and like or his jacket and like getting him up there and like get back in there like he's doing that with other characters throughout. Like he's this kind of this coach of like what's right and you need to this is what you need to do to win this fight. And you know, like whether he's doing that with other characters who, what was the character who was killed by the whiskey palette?
Dugan.
Yeah, like he's coaching him after he gets pummeled by the mob at their kind of little rally at the church, and he's like, I'm with you, I'll back you. So Yeah, he immediately...
You stand up, I'll stand up with you.
Yeah, he immediately becomes this kind of moral coach for everybody, which is an obvious choice but for a priest. But at the same time, you gain this affection for him because he initially does assume this kind of useless, hey, I'll pray for you type role, which feels meaningless. Yeah. In the face of death.
Yeah, it's an interesting combination of speaking the truth and acting, right?
Yeah.
Not acting as in the craft, but action. Truth and action have to go hand in hand. So if you know, you can get together in the church and you can say what's true and you can speak those things, but if you don't stand up and you don't physically take action toward making the truth happen or making the truth a reality, it means nothing.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite scenes, actually, I thought it was, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that his performance when Dugan gets killed in the ship is actually one of the more powerful performances of the film. I thought, to me, anyway, it was more powerful than the I Could Have Been a Contender scene.
Well, it is interesting because he continues to stand up for that even in the face of mockery.
Yeah.
Physically and verbally, and there's a lot of tension in that because he's also in a low to high position, right? Like he's at the bottom of this kind of pit, being stoned, if you will, and he's a martyr who hasn't died. He kind of represents all the martyrs of the film, what they would have said after their death. He's there at the beginning in the first murder. He's there at the the second murder where the whiskey pallet falls, like, and he still speaks truth even from the bottom of the pit, which is kind of an interesting visual as well. But it's also interesting because he's yelling upwards, which is almost like a plea, like... It's almost like
a prayer.
Yeah, prayer to higher power.
Yeah.
One of the higher powers just happens to be corrupt, but it's a plea to the goodness of those around him on his level.
Mm-hmm.
And possibly.
I really like that scene. That's I thought that one was one of the more emotionally charged scenes in the film. The other scene that I really liked as well was when Terry goes back to Edie's house and he breaks in and she says, get out of here. And he says, you love me. And she says, I didn't say I didn't love you. I said, stay away from me. I really like that scene. Although I always get a kick out of these old fashioned movies when the answer to a hysterical woman is just grab them and kiss them.
Yeah.
Just
completely
kills me every time.
It's so funny.
It's like that like completely ends the argument.
Yeah. It's like, oh, that's what she really wanted. She just wanted to be kissed.
Yeah. They love it and they don't complain
anymore.
It's
true.
They were responsible.
You see that so
brother?
Much in old films. It just kills me every time.
It is really funny, actually. Yeah. It's very cliche. Yeah. She's like losing it, and then it's just like simply like it's like, but it is an interesting, like, it's a lot of tension, like it could become a really awful scene. But it's like, oh, thank goodness they just kissed. That could have been way worse. I was pretty worried there.
So now, Alex, as a married man married to a fiery Latina woman, is that ever the answer?
Yeah.
When she's mad at you, she wants you to get the hell away from her, to just grab her and kiss her. Does that work?
No.
What?
What would her response be?
Not in my experience, it doesn't.
Have you tried it?
Probably punching me in the face.
Maybe you should try it next time.
Maybe. Maybe I will.
Yeah. Yeah, get her really mad.
Really when
you can report back to
when
us.
When I want to end my life, I will do it. That would be a really smart form of suicide.
I was conducting research for a podcast.
Yeah, no, I don't think that would work.
You don't think so?
No.
Worth a try, though. God. It's so funny how often that occurs in these old films.
Like, did you guys saw Breakfast at Tiffany's?
I hate that film.
Me too, but...
That's another classic that I watched it. I was like, what the hell is this frivolous film all about? It's so stupid.
Yeah, it's really stupid.
And I think that's the only way to describe that film personally, is just frivolous.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's the same thing. Like, she only cares about jewelry and that's it.
But it's not true, because at the end, she falls in love.
But at the end.
And they have the whole Mrs. Robinson scene, you know, like in The Graduate, where they drive away in the taxi together.
Yeah, and the cat is in the rain, and poor little cat, man.
Yeah.
What did he do to deserve that? I don't like that movie either.
It's a lot of cat dissing.
I think I watched. Yeah. I didn't love it. I watched 8.5 by Federico Fellini last week.
Yeah.
It's another classic. I never liked it, honestly. I couldn't understand it. I understood it more this time, but something like that happens too. Like, a woman gets angry, he goes and kisses her. And he fixes everything. Italian love.
Yeah. Wow. Another one. Okay, so another classic, a more modern classic that I find very inaccessible is Pulp Fiction.
Really?
Really?
Yeah. That is a film I've watched about 6 or 7 times now to try and understand it. But every time I watch it, I hate it. I can't stand that film.
I watched it, I think, 2 years ago, the last time I watched it. And it was the first time I watched it. And I had never seen that film. It was different.
Well, it's another one of those classic, like, you know, Alex and I went to film school, and everybody raves about this film.
Yeah.
They call it, you know, one of the more important films of the 90s. And so I've tried desperately to appreciate the film. Every time I'm bored to death. The only scene that I like is the Christopher Walken scene where he tells the kid that he hid his dad's pocket watch up his ass for however many months. Because it's Christopher Walken. That's what makes it so good.
Yeah. You can lift
out the whole boxing character. You can lift out the whole Bruce Willis boxing story, and the film is the same and shorter and probably more palatable.
You know what? Like, the reason why I watched it was like, because I was like, I can't believe I haven't watched this film. I feel bad. Like, it's a classic, apparently. And I did enjoy it. I do have to say, like, I think Quentin Tarantino is very good at just building tension. Like, throughout his entire films, like, you just watch them and you're like, oh man, like, this is, nothing's happened and I know something really tough to watch is going to happen. You just know that with his films, and he's very good at building the tension. I do have to say that, like, as much as I did, like, enjoy the film, I can't say that I feel like the quake that of the cultural quake that everybody claims that it had. You know, I thought it was, like, interesting to watch, and the tension was obviously masterfully done, but at the same time I kind of agree with you. I don't know why it's so prominent in the minds of so many people as this film is iconic.
I think it's because of the storytelling.
The structure is unique.
The structure wasn't something that you see every day.
It's true. It's very different
for that time, and every filmmaker saw it and was like, this is impressive, and just look at how many pretentious filmmakers try to imitate.
I guess
that's
true. Yeah, I've always found, like, the thing about Quentin Tarantino that I always appreciate is he is very much a person that just goes against the grain, like, structure, everything. Yeah. So I've, like, I actually have had a growing appreciation for him more and more over the years, including when I watched that film. I always loved Kill Bill. But
See, again, like I actually hate most of Tarantino's work.
That's interesting.
I find it absolutely boring. I can't stand it.
Overly.
Only ones that I believe that Inglourious Bastards is an absolute masterpiece.
It's a great film.
I love that film.
Yeah.
And I like most of Django, but I hated Hateful Eight. I hated Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and pretty much everything else he's done.
Oh, you hated Once Upon a Time in Hollywood? I thought you were. I thought that was one you liked.
Lord, no. I turned to my friend after half an hour and I said, "What the hell is this film about? Why am I watching Margot Robbie walk around and just watch herself on TV and keep cutting back to Margot Robbie watching herself in a movie theater?" I'm happy to be wrong about the film. I know a lot of people who are a lot smarter than me really like this film. But that one I could not stand.
A lot of people didn't like that film, though. A lot of critics really gave that film a hard time.
Mm.
But I don't know.
I saw tons of positive reviews of it.
Hateful Eight, I wasn't as on board with. To be honest, like, Django's okay. Django's okay. I don't love Django. And I do like Pulp Fiction probably the most, aside from Inglourious Bastards. Inglourious Bastards is at the top for me. But I did watched Kill Bill.
Like, it's a masterpiece.
Kill Bill is
around.
Just like a bit of a punch in the face constantly. It's stylistically, it was interesting too, but I liked it, but it was one of those films where it was like, I kind of hated the over the top gore at the same time. Like, it was a lot of it that I really didn't like, but that also I was just like, it grips you.
He's having fun with it. And that's pretty cool. Like, he just did it. Because he wanted to, and that's kind of cool, and you don't see that a lot.
Look, he's very different.
I 100% respect him as a filmmaker, and I recognize all of the elements that are so good about his films. You know, like, that was the thing that I found so weird about Upon a Time in Hollywood was that everyone was so fantastically good. Like, Brad Pitt was amazing. Leo was amazing. and the sets, and like, there was really funny moments, like the Bruce Lee stuff, but I hated the film.
You really have to get through the first 75.
The way I see it, I think
the first 75.
You have to stick with it.
Of all his filmography, this is the only one. Like, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is the only one that doesn't feel like a full story. Mm. It feels more like little events happening here and then. Like, it doesn't feel like one big story, like Inglourious Basterds or Pulp Fiction. You have many stories, but everything is connected. Here it just feels like he, in my opinion, like, I know some people love it like crazy more than all of his other films, but it just feels like little events throughout the '60s.
Much of just like hanging out with people as they're walking. Like the shot of Leo and his wife and Brad Pitt just walking through the airport, and it's just this long wonder of them pushing their baggage through.
I still enjoyed it, but I understand and I see that, right? Like, I'm not gonna deny it.
Yeah.
And I remember when I went to film school in Mexico, like, I remember everyone was obsessed with Tarantino and I liked him, but I couldn't understand why until years later. It's just like people love how he tells his stories and how violent he is and how he can get away with anything. And the studios are like, yeah, man, go kill people. I don't care.
That's kind of the interesting thing about him, though, is like that I think a good percentage of his films, you're like, what is this movie about? Like, I felt the same way about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Now, the idea of that is similar to that of Pulp Fiction in that it's like, it's little pieces, little stories that are interlinked. It's kind of a broader Pulp Fiction, I guess. But you tolerate it more because you're like, I know this is Quentin Tarantino, so I know he's going somewhere with this. So I'm going to stick with it. Maybe more so than you would have with Pulp Fiction. But again, I think what he does masterfully is he builds tension enough for you to just be like, where is this going? Where is this going? And to the point where it's frustrating, and it's like it all comes together and you're like, oh, okay. Like, it's a bit of a very long, confused build. I think that he took some liberties with the fact that he's Quentin Tarantino with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, but I did enjoy it in the end.
Yeah.
You did have to kind of wait for it.
Look,
but with Pulp Fiction,
I loved the action scene where he kills the Mansons. I thought that was hilarious.
That was hilarious.
It was,
yeah,
but like it all built to that.
Here's my question about that film.
Huh?
Yes.
What was it?
And like, here's my big question about that film. And I know we're not on the waterfront anymore, but I think that's okay.
That's okay.
I think my question with that is, okay, so when I watched Inglourious Basterds the first time, I was in the middle of a history degree, and I was absolutely enthralled with this film. And at the end, when they killed Hitler, I was really upset because I didn't think that you could or should do that. But then I talked to my friend, and he's like, no, it's an alternate universe, and it's fine. And then I came around to it. Now I really enjoy that idea. But I think that same idea is taken in a different direction, where someone who did die tragically is now not dead. Is that okay to do that? I don't know. That feels different to me than killing someone who was reprehensibly bad, than someone who was good and died and then erasing their death. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah.
How do you feel about that? Like, to me, that was weird.
For all the interviews that I saw of him, like, what he tried to do in the film is obviously presenting how Hollywood was changing, and they weren't looking for the talent that Leo had anymore. And when they kill, what's her name? I forgot.
Sharon Tate.
Yeah. When they kill her, it's like they killed the innocence of Hollywood or something like that.
Okay.
I think I heard him saying something like that. For him, it was like the moment they killed her, the cinema became more crude, more raw in the 70s.
It's quite a statement from Tarantino.
Yeah. I think it was kind of like that. I think I read something like that, and he tried to make it more like, you know, the same that with Hitler, like try to fix history or something like that. Yeah. I think like I'm talking of something that I saw probably a year ago. I don't remember exactly what he said or if he said it or someone else said it. I can't remember for sure.
All right. How do we feel about the end of On the Waterfront where where Terry fights the guy finally, the villain?
It's his redemption fight.
The face fight.
He's not... He went in and he faced the demons for all, but he also had his rematch.
Yeah, essentially.
And he won.
I like it because there's an idea in it that the only way, and I think you see this throughout the film and it's mirrored in this scene in particular, is that obviously Terry has now become the spokesperson and the voice of truth in the film, and now he goes and he gets beat up, but the only way that he loses is if the mob gets involved and like all of those guys have to beat him up. So there's kind of an idea working, I think, that truth is overcome by, how can I say this, truth is essentially suppressed by groups. Right? And it takes all of those people to press him down. But even still, even though he gets the shit kicked out of him, he still rises up again, and then the truth does prevail. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
I'm forming that thought as I speak.
But it's also the suppression of the truth is caused by groups, but also the acceptance of the greater collective, and that whole scene is him fighting to break that influence over the greater the crowd, right? Like the audience. And
yeah,
they all just they all in the end ignore the power that suppressed the truth, you know, like he's screaming at them, I won't forget your faces, like all of you, blah blah blah, but all of them end up going to work that day. And they like the him just like fighting for truth creates this acceptance, like, and that is obviously like a truth, is that if you fight for the truth, the truth does prevail. Like it becomes more obvious to people. It's like, of course, is what we should have been doing. But it takes overcoming. Like, he didn't die in this process. Like other people did. Other people were forced into the shadows and to their ultimate, you know, condemnation and death. Whereas he like, even in the deaths of people that tell the truth, they're kind of in places of in the hidden in the dark, right? Like at night, thrown off the roof, in the pit, in the body of a ship, in the shadows, right? Like all of these places are, they're kind of these dark settings, and he kind of brings truth into the light and fights for it there in front of everybody and gets beaten up. But then the father comes out and he coaches him back up, like, get back up, because this is just the battle, you've lost it, but the actual war is to be won, and you just have to get up. It's another round.
Well, it's an idea that exactly, but also that the truth prevailing creates a better world for everyone else around him as well,
right? And to have fought for that, he truly fights for it. He actually makes the one thing that no one else does in the film is everyone's aware of the fact that somebody snitched. But when he does it, he snitches, but his becomes more and more public and not ignorable, to the point where he's like, all right, I'm going to punch this guy in the face in front of everybody, you know?
Yeah.
It ends up behind the shed at one point, almost to show like it's a place where it could be hidden from everybody else. But at the same time, like, it's all done in broad daylight. He's testifying in court, all of this stuff. His approach is different. It's like, I'm not going to do this in secret and hope that I, you know, come out unscathed. He's like, I'm going to do this in front of everybody, and I'm going to bleed in front of everybody. It's almost like it's a sacrificial thing, whereas no one else felt like a sacrifice.
Yeah, essentially he's a Christ figure, essentially, at that end when he gets up and he's bloody and beaten and he walks up the hill and then into the I guess, well, it looks more like a tomb than anything, right? Because this is a big dark warehouse he's going into. But in terms of production design, because this did win production design, I like the setting of the, and you guys can tell me what you think about this, of the boss's warehouse or whatever clubhouse sitting on the ocean like that.
Yeah.
It's like floating on that. And the reason why I like that is because water symbolizes chaos and the unknown, right? So the boss, who is controlling and manipulating everybody to his own personal ends, is sitting on top of chaos, and then he goes and he fights him, and then he gets pushed back into the chaos from essentially where he comes from, which I really like.
And that's where the title comes from.
Is it?
Water, chaos, front, on.
It's cool because it works like that. You can see how the construction of the sets mirrors the subtext and the psychology of the film.
Do you think it's interesting too, like how there's this, the house is kind of this just like small, insignificant floating boathouse that's docked next to this gigantic, almost cruise liner ship. Like, I thought that was kind of an interesting thing, and that's where the film starts. And they're early on when they establish that setting or that scene, that you have this giant liner ship in the back, which almost it looks classy, and then you have this like grungy little layer going on as well. And to me, like, that visual almost, like, that setting, because the villains are in that kind of lair, this, like, it almost looks insignificant and minor and gross, and there's, like, this kind of beautiful thing in the background, this giant monster of a nice ship that can go anywhere, you know? I did think that that was the feeling I saw when I saw that framing was like, there's kind of this, there's kind of like a, this hopefulness about like looking at something like that in the background. Mm-hmm. Like you, cause there's so many films use that visual as something that's like setting out, you know, on, it exemplifies adventure, hope, something like that. So I don't know. I did think that was interesting as well. Yeah. I don't know. Just a thought.
Good.
So deep.
So deep. And then, the, of course, the pigeons.
Ball in here.
We should probably talk about the pigeons.
Oh, yeah. They kill them. That's so unfair.
They kill the pigeons.
Yeah.
They're
the animals pigeons. In the movie.
Alex.
Tell me.
Now, because you're from Mexico City, do you have a good relationship with cops there or not?
No.
So this is, again, this is one of those things that was so far removed from us, was the idea of like a negative relationship with cops. And, you know, everyone's like, the kids are upset that he talks to the cops.
Yeah.
Can you speak to that at all? Because that's so far beyond people who grew up in Vancouver.
My... Yeah, no, in Mexico, cops are more dangerous than a thief, so. Yeah, it's pretty much that. Like, you can't trust cops. Normally, they have such a low income that they are going to rob you instead of help you.
Right.
So, it's not something, they're not trustworthy people. Like, really, it sounds awful to say this, but you're better trying to make justice on your own than going for the cops, unless it's something awful is really happening. But
yeah,
they're not gonna do anything, really. Most of the time, they, like, I don't know, if someone robs you somewhere, they probably know who robbed you, and they're gonna back them up, and they are just gonna tell you to remain quiet if you know what's good for you.
Yeah. So is that an element of the film that you can understand then? The whole...
Yeah, I can understand that. It's sad because we're in 2020 and we're still going through that in Mexico, and it's also the same in countries like Colombia, or well, almost everywhere in Latin America, cops are not trustworthy.
Mm.
It's kind of sad, but yeah, I can understand that.
So then you can see like the appeal essentially of the union, right? And someone who's supposed to be standing up for you.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, those
an
are things
alternative
that
justice,
you can relate to. Yeah. Yeah. And it's really sad. Like, you hear stories like that in Mexico a lot.
Mm.
It's not nice. It's not nice. I miss Vancouver.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's all right.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of the things that struck me with the film is like how they did a great job of showing how harsh not only the living conditions were, but how harsh the people are. You know, all that chatter at the beginning when they're just backbiting and just brutal comments to one another, and like everything's a threat. Everybody's always like, "What are you looking at? What are you talking about? Like, F you, I'm not trying to talk to you," and all that sort of attitude that's just so hostile. Everything was so hostile in that environment.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Did you guys watch Do the Right Thing from Spike Lee?
No.
No, that's, again, one of those ones that I know of, but I've never sat through.
Watch it. It's really good, and it has a lot of cop-related things of, like, the idea that we're talking about right now.
Right.
It's pretty good. Check it out.
Okay.
Yeah, do it.
All right. Well, is there anything else we should talk about this film?
I don't think so.
Nice.
Yeah. So what do we rate this film then?
Jono?
I don't want to give it a bad rating just because I didn't sit.
Well, just give it a truthful rating. Brando's not going to see it. It's okay.
That's true. I'd give it a 7 or 6. I'll give it a 6.
A 6?
Yeah, I guess.
Well, I'm looking at IMDb, and it's got an 8.1. Yeah.
I would give it a 7.5.
Can I just kid it? Put it at a 7. I'll put it at a 7. You know what? That
no, no. Stand by your backing, Jono. It's okay.
All right, and then I was never invited back to a podcast episode of Film Buffs again.
Yeah,
he's not a film buff.
He's a film he's a jerk, film
butthead.
All right. Well, I liked a lot of this, even though some of it was inaccessible from just experience and time. I think this is a good solid 8. I like this one.
Cool. Yeah, it was good.
I really do want to say that I wish that I paid more attention to it. That's all. That I was more engaged in it. I think it was fine. Like the more we talk about it, like the more I warm up to it, and the more I realize I remember from the 3 viewings I had, 2.5.
That's a good movie.
It's fine. It has value. It's good.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this has been On the Waterfront and many other segues. Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.